KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
49 Seattle.
I don't like it. I want to democratize voices. I want real citizen engagement. I want two-way conversations. I want citizenship to be redefined.
I woke up and turned on my phone and went to Facebook, I think, and pretty much everyone's status was, you know, number one in the nation. So literally everyone. I don't think I saw any other statuses but that.
I said something like, I'm a mathematician and I would like to stand on your roof. But he was really cool about it. He took me up there and we talked about fractals.
You're going to learn more about fractals from ethnomathematician Ron Eglash. He's our guest later this hour. Gonzaga guard Mike Hart talking about the Bulldogs being number one in the nation, and former San Francisco mayor, now Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, on why we should integrate social media into politics. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off this week. Okay, it is only March, but here in the Pacific Northwest, we are starved for happy sports news, and we're going to take what comes our way. So here it goes. Yesterday, the Gonzaga University Bulldogs topped the AP college basketball rankings. Meanwhile, down in Arizona, the team that plays in Safeco Field has been taken over by baseball-savvy aliens. They're now on a 10-game winning streak. So what is up? Joining us with the happy sports talk this morning is Art Thiel, founder of Sports Press Northwest. Good morning, Art.
Good morning. Happy talk in sports.
Yeah, well, where are we? What city is this?
This is a parallel universe.
Well, let's just enjoy it while we're here. And let's start with Gonzaga. The team has been a basketball powerhouse for at least a decade, I think. So what has propelled them into number one?
The flatness of the surrounding territory.
Oh.
No, I mean, that's part of it. But there is an amazing amount of parity in college basketball this year. And that has helped the climb. There's no super team. There's no big favorite. Gonzaga is one of a dozen teams, I think, that could win the national championship. And what has kept them back traditionally has been the weakness of their conference. The West Coast Conference is what's known in the parlance as a mid-major. It is not a powerhouse among the top six conferences, known as the BCS in football. And so their schedule has never been given much credit because they're often beating up on very weak teams. But they've got a good opponent in St. Mary's in their league, and no one else is doing anything better. And so Gonzaga has put together a really good team that I think has more than fair shot at winning the title.
So are you saying that they really deserve to be number one, or that everybody else doesn't deserve to be number one?
I think everybody deserves to be number one. I think you and I deserve to be number one.
If I could shoot a basket, I'd probably get that. Are the rankings based on win-loss records strictly?
Well, that is certainly a major factor, but they also are based on strength of schedule. There's a sort of a complicated formula that the basketball selection committee uses for the tournament called ratings percentage index.
Oh, my.
But the poll is a human poll that basically is sports writers saying, who's the best this week? And they say Gonzaga is the best this week. And the amazing thing about it is that has never happened to a state college in Washington in the 70 years they've been doing these things.
Ever?
Ever. Yeah, what? Not Washington, not Washington State, and not Seattle U, even in its heyday with the great Elgin Baylor in the late 50s.
Wow. Well, so we're 2 weeks out, I think exactly 2 weeks out from the start of the NCAA tournament. What is a number one ranking this week mean going into that tournament?
Well, it means that they're likely to be one of four number one seeds. The field is divided into four regions. Each of them has teams ranked 1 through 16, and Gonzaga undoubtedly will be a number one, which is always the most favorable position in any region. We don't know which region, probably the West, but they have demonstrated, I think, that they're certainly in the top four. You could probably split hairs about who is 1, 2, and 3, and 4, but they will be a number one seed in the tournament, and that is the best position you can have going into the task of winning six in a row to be national champion.
And that's because you start with the lowest ranked team as your first opponent, right?
Right. Yeah, the one will play 16, two plays 15, and so on. So the number one is always in the catbird seat starting out the tournament. But it's still a question of winning six in a row, and with so many evenly matched teams in the top dozen or 15 programs, it wouldn't surprise anybody if Gonzaga, was defeated at one point. But that's just, again, another testament to how even everything is in college ball this year.
Well, it'll be a fun tournament to watch then.
Yes, lots of upsets, lots of hearts enlivened and broken.
All right, well, now let's move from chilly Spokane to Peoria, Arizona, where a team seems to be masquerading as the Mariners, and they just won their 10th game, 16-2, was it, or 16-6?
16-6, I think.
Okay, 10th straight game. I also read that this team masquerading as the Mariners leads every team in home runs.
Yes.
All right, so who are these people?
Well, it's obviously the key here is that they brought in the fences at Safeco. So the psychological effect is already working its way through the Mariners lineup. No longer are they hitting in Safeco National Park. They're hitting in a bandbox, and so they've just sort of dispensed with all of that. More seriously, they have added some pop in their lineup this year. Kendrys Morales and Michael Morse and Raul Ibanez and even Jason Bay, 34-year-old broken-down guy who played two terrible years with the Mets, they're hitting home runs. And it is the desert. It is warmer air.
Mm-hmm.
Warm. You remember warm air. We had a little bit of it in August.
Yeah.
And the ball tends to fly in those circumstances. And, of course, we all know it's spring training. Repeat right. after me. Mm-hmm. It's all just spring training. But the fact is that it is worth something from the standpoint of hitters knowing what they're capable of. And whether the ball goes out at Safeco is less material than hitting the ball well anywhere they play.
Now, I have to go back 12 years, I think, to the last good season that I can remember, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that one. Was that a good year for spring training for the M's? Or?
Well, that's a very good example to bring up. No, they were 13-19.
Ouch.
And so there was the past performances in spring training are indicators of nothing in terms of the outcome. The real predictor is the month of April. Every time the Mariners have had a winning April, they have had a winning season. And a losing April has always meant a losing season. So that's the barometer that we're all going to be watching, and it's coming up pretty quickly. Spring training, no, because, for example, last year's leading hitter for the Mariners in spring training was Munenori Kawasaki,
uh-huh.
the backup shortstop who barely played the entire year and ended up hitting 192 and was cut. So that is what you take from spring training numbers.
Okay, well, now I'm going to put on the Happy Talk hat back and just say I'm a sports psychologist, which I'm not and don't claim to be, but doesn't momentum, even though they're warm and they're in the desert and everybody's happy because the sun is shining and they're going to come here and it's cold and gray, but isn't there something about momentum that begets more momentum?
Well, there's an old saying in baseball that momentum is the next day's pitcher, and that basically means that if your pitching guy is better than their pitching guy, you're going to have a better chance to win that next day's game. Momentum is a very elusive thing in baseball because it's 162 games. The best shot we ever saw here in momentum was the 1995 season when the Mariners could hardly lose in the last 6 weeks of that season. That's a real rare thing. What is sustaining is getting quality talent and having it perform at a career average level, not the career best level. That's what happened in 2001, and that will not happen again in the lifetimes of great-great-grandchildren. But the idea of being able to have average major league players contribute at average levels in all nine positions would be a major breakthrough over the last decade for the Mariners. It would get them to 500. It might even get them to 85, 88 wins, and that would be a big deal given where we've been.
Do we have average major league players?
Well, the new acquisitions are closer to that than they have been in about 8 or 9 years. And so it remains to be seen if health and and an improved pitching staff will all contribute as well. But I think a winning season is a reasonable expectation. I don't think winning 10 games in a row is too reasonable. But, hey, we had a perfect game last year, so who knows?
And that was sure fun to celebrate. So I will take the happy part away with me, Art, and have hope singing in my heart like that poet says it should be on the tree. Art Teals, a sports writer and founder of Sports Press Northwest. Opening day for the M's is...
Boy, you got a good question there.
Okay, well, one of our listeners.
It will be cold, it will be gray, but the Mariners will be 20-5 out of spring training, and you're just entitled to your happiness as much as anyone else. Please enjoy.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Art.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday on KUOW. All this week, EarthFix, our environmental news partners, are bringing us audio postcards of someone who has a personal stake in the Northwest's proposal to build coal export terminals. Here is Voices of Coal.
My name is Captain Ann McIntyre, and I'm a Columbia River pilot.
Yes, we're going to go starboard side alongside there.
This way.
A Columbia River pilot is a navigation expert. They're experts in ship handling, transiting a very narrow river, and then docking and undocking ships.
Starboard 10.
Starboard 10. Rudder on starboard 10, Mom.
Okay. I think most people assume that it's the captain of the ship that brings the ship into port.
220.
We work under the radar. Nobody knows that we're there, but we are a 365-day-a-year, 24/7 operation where we're moving ships all the time.
Let's come slow ahead.
Slow ahead.
Captains of ships are qualified to navigate oceans and go all over the world, but they really can't learn all the local knowledge that every port requires in order for a ship to call in that port. So we're the person with the local knowledge.
Starboard anchor are ready.
Okay, thank you very much.
I don't view a coal ship as being any different than any other ship that I navigated. I would treat it with the same standard of care that I treat all my jobs. If you could put grain in it, you could put steel in it, you could put fertilizer in it. It's the same type of ship, it's just that the cargo's different.
Captain, how many different kinds of cargo have you loaded on board your vessel?
On board here, we load last voyage, we load sugar from Brazil.
Sugar from Brazil?
Yeah.
And now today, steel?
Yeah, today's,
on the same ship.
Today, steel.
So you've loaded coal on board this vessel?
Yeah.
A pilot's job really is to mitigate risk, and we view ourselves as being on the front lines of defending the environment.
Gold Bush, go ahead.
We've heard some concern expressed that because coal ships are large, that makes a navigational safety issue. And quite frankly, we bring large ships in the river routinely, 900 feet long, 1,000 feet long. If you put that ship on end, it would be taller than a building in downtown Portland. But that is what we do.
Yeah, that'd be great. Go ahead and come on up our port side. Thanks for the call.
I think the likelihood of coal spilling out of a ship onto the river is just about nil.
Starboard 10.
Rudder on starboard 10, Mom.
Okay.
It's Columbia River pilot Ann McIntyre. She supports proposed coal terminals. We want to know what you think. You can email us at weekday@kuow.org and find a link to the entire series Voices of Coal at our website. That's kuow.org.
It's 9:19. Computer science and social justice in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture. Proud supporters of the National Parks Conservation Association. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
KUOW and Seattle Children's Theater present The Edge of Peace. A mystery surrounds a community when a beloved World War II soldier is reported missing in action. February 28th through March 17th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW Earth.org.
It's 47 degrees in Seattle, cloudy, and the forecast says rain is likely today. That's the weather forecast. We'll get a hike to suit the week's weather forecast in about 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off this week. Ron Eglash is a mathematician and a cyberneticist, and you can look up those words and still be a little bit confused. Professor Eglash works with the intersections between technology, community development, culture, and race. He's a professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and he joins us in the studios today, and he's going to demystify all those words for us, or at least try to, right?
I'll do my best.
Do your best. Well, you're an ethnomathematician, which is something I've never heard of. So what is that exactly?
So ethnomathematician is somebody who brings together anthropology, which is the study of culture, with mathematics, and in particular mathematical modeling. So we're very interested in how you can use geometry or algebra or some other formal system to describe something that folks are doing out in their daily lives in some culture.
How did you get interested in that field?
Well, I was getting my engineering degree at UCLA and worked at National Semiconductor as an engineer for a little while. And then I went back to school in cultural studies in a program called History of Consciousness at University of California at Santa Cruz. And so I was trying to bring the engineering background together with this cultural and political analysis. And I thought that looking at third world development, technology transfer might be a good place to do that. So that's where I got started with this.
Was one of the sort of assumptions or questions behind wanting to do that the fact that we're not particularly culturally savvy when we export technologies from the U.S. to, say, the African subcontinent?
Well, yeah. So that was the technology development literature. But there was one particular study that caught my eye. There was an anthropologist, Pat Kaplan, who had done a study in Tanzania. And she described how women in this one village had a lot of autonomy. So even though it was a Muslim culture, they could divorce their husbands if they wanted to. If their kids were bothering them, they would go and build a little house for the kids. If they wanted to divorce their husband, they would build a house for themselves. So the architecture, their ability to have usufructory rights to the land, as we say, to be able to use a piece of land whenever they needed to, that was tied to their social independence. Hmm. Now, they had a modernization program where they would bring in concrete blockhouses and put them in roads. And so the anthropologist said, you know, it seems like this is going to be a disaster for women's autonomy in this village. Well, I knew what concrete blockhouses and roads looked like. It's like a Cartesian grid, right? Mm-hmm. But what did the village look like before that? So I wrote to her and asked her if she could send me some aerial photographs of that village, and she did. They weren't terribly good aerial photographs, but something clicked, and I thought, you know, that looks kind of like a fractal.
Okay, explain fractal. I had to ask my teenage son, and I'm still not sure I understand anything more except repeating pattern.
That's about it. So it's a pattern that repeats at different scales. So when you look at my face, I'm symmetric, right? The right half of my face looks like the left half of my face.
Mm-hmm.
But that's symmetry within the same scale. When we talk about scaling symmetry, we mean a resemblance between different scales. So a little piece looks like the big piece.
So a little bit like those Russian Kachinka dolls that nest inside one another?
Kind of like the Russian dolls, but they're symmetric to one point, and these are globally symmetric. I'll show you a better example of that. So look at your thumb,
okay,
and your index finger,
mm-hmm,
and there's a place where the two of them meet.
All right.
And you need to relax your hand a little bit,
okay,
there. So now you've got kind of a big wrinkle there.
Yes.
And within that, you can see some smaller wrinkles. And
uh-huh.
Within that, you can see some smaller wrinkles.
I see.
So a tree has a branch of a branch of a branch. A cloud has a puff of a puff of a puff.
I see.
So mountains are jaggedness within jaggedness.
So this is like me as a kid laying there on the ground thinking about how vast the universe might be. And
kind of like that, yeah.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, we're talking with Ron Eglash, who's, as you hear, trying to make this comprehensible to a math-phobic individual. So you saw this aerial photograph, and you thought about concrete blockhouses and how that wasn't at all what this village would have been on its own merits.
Yeah.
Rows of houses, not it.
Not rows of houses. So these were houses that are shaped like a cylinder, what we often call a hut. But hut comes from a German word that means shack. It's a little bit derogatory, so I just use the word house.
Mm.
So they're houses that are shaped like a cylinder, but the houses are in circles. So it's a circle of circles, and that circle is in circles. So it's a circle of circles.
Is that layout conscious? Was it, or is that the aesthetic of this particular community?
Well, the reason I talked about trees and clouds and wrinkles on our skin is because that's where fractals had been applied. So before I started looking at the cultural material, all the examples I had heard of were in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And nature doesn't have a conscious way of self-organizing things into fractals. If you look at termite mounds, those are fractals. If you look at coral reefs, those are fractals. But it's not like termites understand fractal geometry.
Sure.
They didn't take classes in it or anything.
Probably not, no.
So my assumption was that Africans were doing the same thing. It was just unconscious social dynamics from the bottom up, so to speak, that was causing these fractals. It wasn't until I got to Africa and started interviewing people that I found out there was a whole other side to it.
And you went to Ghana, is that right, where you did...
The initial field work I did was in seven different countries. So Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Cameroon, and Benin.
A little earlier this hour, we played a clip of you saying you would knock on people's doors and say, hey, can I go up on your roof? I'm a mathematician. I want to check it out. And people would say yes.
Well, not everybody's door, but yeah. So occasionally I needed to get up in elevation and... You have to talk people into letting you do that, which is not a normal request.
And as I understand from a presentation that you gave, a TED Talk that you gave, this organization, this architectural community organization, the infrastructure organization, actually sort of goes back to the spiritual religious organization. It sounded like for some of these locations.
In a lot of cases, yeah. I didn't find one underlying reason for why people were building fractals. So you go to one village and they give you one explanation, and a different village they give you a different explanation. But a lot of them were very tied into a kind of cosmology or spiritual belief. Yes.
So these go back centuries. The fractal organization of African villages. And that's great, and it's fascinating on an academic level. What do you do with this field work? You are a professor of science and technology, not of, well, maybe you are a professor of fractal geometry, but I don't think you are. So you go do this field work. You've written books about this. But what does that mean for this African village or for me?
I think you're moving a little quick to the practical.
Okay. You want to take me one.
We should just celebrate the discovery. It's absolutely fascinating.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I don't mean to take anything away from what you do.
here you've got Europeans for centuries focusing on Euclidean geometry, on circles and squares and rectangles. And it wasn't until relatively recently that they started looking at this other way of thinking about geometric organization.
So
that in itself is a pretty significant result.
Does it also indicate a huge cultural gap in assumptions that we've made about Africa?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So when we apply this work, a lot of it is in the field of education. And when I speak to teachers that have large numbers of African-American students in the classroom, sometimes they're a little bit skeptical. And some of them have even said to me, well, I think my kids are ashamed of being of African descent. I don't think they want to have anything to do with Africa. And the reason for that is centuries of these assumptions that there's a kind of ladder of progress and Africans are on the bottom and Europeans are on the top. So this is a wonderful opportunity to upset that ladder in a kind of academic, intellectual way.
Now, from African village fractals, there's something much closer to home that you've looked at, and that's people's heads.
Yeah. So when I first started working with math teachers and asking about this, I asked them, out of all the examples in the book, what do you think your kids would connect with the most? And they all said the same thing. They said, oh, the fractals in cornrow hairstyles. That's something that kids can connect to because that's part of the living culture. That's still something people are innovating with. So that was our first simulation that we put online. And the National Science Foundation was very generous in helping us develop that further. And so now we have lots of these simulations.
So essentially, what if I look at cornrows, the way that those are fractals is those that are repeating, the braiding patterns are repeated patterns that are large to small.
Yes, and large to small. They're scaling patterns.
Scaling patterns, and they can, some cornrow patterns are quite elaborate. Some are straight. Some are, they're zigzag.
So you're actually getting into one of the first problems we encountered. So we'd show this to teachers, and they'd say, well, that's awesome, but we don't have any fractal geometry in the K-12 curriculum. So how are you going to help us? So we started breaking down the simulations into the topics that were in the math curriculum, and the most natural connection was with what's called transformational geometry. So there are four geometric transforms. There's rotation, reflection, translation, and scaling or dilation. So if you iteratively, in a loop, so to speak, apply a transformation, you can get copies that get smaller and smaller and smaller, right? That's your scaling transformation. And you can get copies that rotate a little bit each time. So that's your rotation, right? And you can have a braid that's very squished together or spread far apart. That's your translation. And then, of course, since we often do things that are symmetric with our heads, you get reflection. So all four of those geometric transformations can be found in cornrow braiding. But the fact that you're doing them iteratively and that they scale down lets you make the connection to fractals.
So you can use this to teach younger kids math because it's a concrete, it's concrete, it's in their lives.
Yes. But you're not only teaching them mathematics, you're also teaching them a sense of ownership over the mathematics.
Because you're tying it to a cultural heritage.
Yes, which we do all the time. So we're constantly tying math to European heritage. So we say, here's the Pythagorean theorem, and maybe we have a little picture of a marble bust of Pythagoras. So this is a great way of giving other kids a sense of that heritage, identity, and mathematics.
So this fractals, for example, is this just African, or are you finding this sort of organization of a cultural identity in other continents, other places on Earth?
Well, that's why we have the discipline of ethnomathematics. So we do find, I call them geometric design themes. We do find different geometric design themes in different cultures. So one of the groups I've been working a lot with are Native Americans. And there you tend to find things that are set up like the Cartesian coordinate system. So you have the four winds, the four directions. The Navajo have four sacred mountains. Mm-hmm. Many cultures have four sacred colors. The persistence of fourfold symmetry is incredibly strong in Native American design. Now, a few years back, I was invited to come out to the Shoshone-Bannock Reservation in Idaho and work with some of the math teachers there. And I told them that, you know, my African Fractals book, I had made a contrast between the fractals in Africa and the lack of fractals in Native American design. And they said, well, come out anyways. So I got out there, and everybody was doing this beautiful beadwork. So we created a virtual bead loom and immediately started getting these ugly, jagged lines in it. So I asked my software developer, you know, how come the Native American beadwork looks so much nicer than your beadwork? And he said, I don't know. So we went back to the reservation and did some more interviews and found out they were using a different algorithm than the algorithm that my developer was using. So we left both of those up there on the simulation so kids can see the difference between the way that he was thinking about it and the way the beadworkers were thinking about it.
I think that you needed to be around, you know, 40 years ago when I was trying to learn geometry. I'm sure there was some pattern that I was missing there. This is just the tip of the iceberg of Ron Eglash's very fascinating research. You can hear more about it this evening. He's going to be appearing as part of University of Washington Graduate School's public lecture series. It's actually Wednesday evening, tomorrow evening at Kane Hall at 6:30. It's free. And if you want more information on that, you can visit engage.washington.edu. Ron Eglash, Professor of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Thanks for your patience walking me through this.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
And we're sticking with technology here for a few minutes with a conversation about how technology can more effectively connect citizens with government. That's next on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Mirror Stage, presenting the Feed Your Mind reading of Impenetrable by Mia McCullough, a West Coast premiere about media images and self-worth at the Ethnic Cultural Theater, March 9th and 10th. Tickets at mirrorstage.org. Theater that gets people talking.
Cloudy sky over Seattle. Forecast says rain is likely today. We're at 47 degrees, and that is today's predicted high. Overnight, expect clouds and showers and a low of 38. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy. Chance of showers and a high of 48.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, committed to helping members fulfill their resolutions for a healthy new year by providing weekly organic fruit and vegetable delivery service throughout the greater Seattle area. Now serving Everett, Issaquah, Bellevue, Tacoma, and Puyallup. More at tinysorganic.com.
Want to reduce your risk of heart disease and stroke? One way might be by eating more olive oil, beans, fish, and vegetables, the so-called Mediterranean diet. We'll get some tips on eating healthier in 30 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. You will surely not be surprised if I tell you that government's a slow-moving, opaque bureaucracy. In this era of information at our fingertips, try finding what you need quickly at a government website. That's something that California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom would love to see changed. He's the former mayor of San Francisco, and during his two terms there, Gavin Newsom tried to incorporate technological solutions to some of the government functions that frustrated his citizenry. Now he's taking that stab at technology a step further. In his new book, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government, Gavin Newsom argues government should not only be more transparent and easy to navigate, he says it's time for bureaucrats to release public information to the public and to let the public help that happen. Lieutenant Governor Newsom is with us in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
My honor. Thanks for having me on.
So you describe modern government, or most modern governments, as sort of a vending machine. Yeah. You want to expand that relationship?
Well, I think it was an interesting way to describe government. You put in a dollar, your taxes, and you get limited choices: police, fire, healthcare, education, national defense. And if you're like me, and I imagine a lot of us, we won't want to admit it, but if you don't like what you get out of the machine, what do? You shake the machine. And that's the protests, the Tea Party on one side, perhaps Occupy Movement on another. And it's a framework of scarcity, of finite choices. And it's a framework that no longer is relevant, I would argue, to the world now that we're living in. This whole world where this net generation, this generation of choice, these digital natives that have grown up, where the world is not customized, or rather standardized, it's customized. You just think about what's happened in the music industry, what's happening in the media industry, financial service industry. You see the contours of this change taking shape. And with government, I think we're on a collision course to the future unless we open up and start to resolve our own inability to address a generation that demands not just choices, but more voice in the day-to-day governing of their city, state, and nation.
So when you came to office in the city of San Francisco, which is in a tech-savvy place, sort of like Seattle, what did you find?
1970s technology, top-down thinking. You vote, guys like me decide. One-way conversation with the taxpayers and voters until election time. Then, oh my gosh, your voice matters. We love you dearly. How are you today? Can you show up and volunteer? Maybe write a check, $5, $10. Amplify your voice, get through election day. We do one nice tweet, a thank you email, and then we turn it off. We go back to a broadcast model for the next 2 and 4 years. And you saw that, sadly, with the inspiration, the aspirational side of mybarackobama.com and the great work they did. 35,000 self-organizing communities in 2008, only to have those voices turned off after that election, save one effort, change.gov. The president infamously put that together, and they said, the online community came together and said, our number one priority, Mr. President, is not getting out of Iraq or Afghanistan at the time, dealing with the war on terror, global climate change, or financial crisis. It's legalizing marijuana. Immediately, that site was turned off, and we went back to the broadcast model.
Because so what happens is it's all a vast experiment, and you talk about that. You tried many. There are special interests always. Special interests in terms of money, but also special interests when you open up the internet channels to the halls of power or the halls of...
There's the King of the Hill syndrome that exists at a town hall meeting where the guys or gals with the loudest voices and stickers with a particular interest exist, and certainly you get that online. And so how do you sort of weed that out? And that's a framework of this book, is how do we create a deliberative process, a participatory process, where we don't have those loud voices drowning out the rest of us?
Now, Citizenville is a direct relation to a game that probably at least 75% of the listeners have played, Farmville.
Yeah.
So what, in your imagination, best possible scenario would Citizenville, the game, be?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this whole idea of gamification, you know, you can't make it up. Zynga is a San Francisco-based company. I remember meeting Mark Pincus when he had about 12 employees, and he told me he had this idea where people were going to virtually farm, and then they're going to spend real money to buy tools. I'm looking at him going, I wanted to say, Mark, this is a cute idea. Good luck. And if you need a job in a few weeks, let me know. Little did I know. And so the whole idea, you know, if you're 8 to 18, you're playing 53 hours a week of online entertainment media. If you're 21 years and younger, you've arguably spent more time playing games than you have in the classroom between 6th and 12th grade. So the idea is to meet people where they are. And you're seeing real movements with games for good, social games that are actually making a difference using civic currency and connecting people where we're getting educated and they'll be more contributory in their cities and communities.
Now, this isn't just pie in the sky, although for most places it is. There's a town called Manor, Texas.
It's an amazing example where they created something called InnoBucks, and it's reputational. And what the idea was simply this, that if you contributed offline to your city, online you would be rewarded reputationally with virtual dollars, not dissimilar to all these games people play. The difference was businesses got so motivated by this, and the local newspaper that promoted it, they started translating the virtual dollars for real discounts in real stores and businesses. And it just created this incredible sense of community, and people gravitated towards this. And it's just one example, small of many examples in the book, of where we're connecting the dot between the virtual world, the online world, and the offline world, the real world.
So some of the examples are not contests per se, but mapping projects. New York had I think New York has had more than one, but there's a bike stand mapping, like where should we put bike parking?
Well, it's all idea. You know, we go to app stores on our iPhone apps. You get 800,000 Android platform. You have 700,000 apps. What about apps for business, for cities? What about apps for the state? And so this is the whole idea. What we started putting these data sets online, and people literally were designing apps within weeks, if not some cases, days, that would have taken government months, if not years, and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And some of those include this ability to map, for example, Boston, interesting example, fire hydrants, people adopting fire hydrants. Now you say, well, what the heck is this? Why am I even listening to this guy? Big deal. Well, it was. Just think about that superstorm they had a few weeks ago that shut down the entire East Coast. Instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of overtime to clean up after the storm around the fire hydrants, people adopted the fire hydrants and they cleaned them up themselves. It's a way of civically connecting people and doing things that only government used to do, but in a way where people are happy to participate and feel more fulfilled in terms of their connection to their community and government. There's thousands, I kid you not, thousands of examples like that and thousands of these apps that are now being built for similar use all across this country.
I'm talking with Gavin Newsom. He's Lieutenant Governor of the state of California. His book is Citizenville, and there are hundreds of examples in this book. And I guess one big question is motivational. It's not just that we want to win, although there are a lot of people who want to be first.
Yeah.
What is it that would get somebody who's a great programmer to design an app for little remuneration for a city or a state.
It is reputational. It's amazing. When we started putting data sets online, basically taking government data that exists in our vaults and just opening it up, when we started doing that, we saw all these apps that were being provided, crime mapping apps, transit apps, recreation park apps, that literally cost taxpayers nothing. And people were doing it for fun. They were doing it for reputation. You don't have to look to spend the money. All it was creating a partnership with the private sector and citizens that want to do the right thing. This is, I argue in the book, this is the new currency of 21st century volunteerism.
Well, that might be us on the citizen side, but you mentioned crime mapping, and one such effort was shut down forcefully in Oakland, California, just across the bay.
Government hates this. I mean,
exactly.
As you say, we're opaque. Our default is secrecy. I mean, you think of President Obama's great struggle with the drone issue. Here's the most transparent president, self-declared, but I would argue legitimately true in American history, that's fighting on the drones, this ready, fire, aim policy as it relates to due process, on the legal memos related to that policy. So it's difficult. When you're in government, you tend not to be as open as you preach when you're out of government arguing to get in.
Well, you got a lot of flack yourself from efforts that you did as mayor of San Francisco, partly media looking to jump on the biggest headline. That's
and it's a good and important thing. And my gosh, don't let up on us, the Freedom of Information Act. But invariably, it's a gotcha frame. I mean, when the press asked me as mayor for information, I went, oh, here we go. What's tomorrow's headline? So again, it's understandable. We're enculturated in terms of this default. And again, bureaucrats across the board are as well. They don't want to be, quote unquote, exposed. And that's a shame. Here's why. Let me give you a quick example. In the 1980s, we opened up satellite technology. Every single person listening, that used to exist only in this National Oceanic Administration agency, the Atmospheric Agency, NOAA. It was publicly funded data that was privately used in the vaults of this agency. We open it up, and as a consequence, you have GPS now. You have AccuWeather. You have the Weather Channel. It's the whole framework. What else exists in our vaults? How can we open up these government-subsidized, government-sponsored data in the Recreation and Parks Department, or down at your planning department, and all of a sudden have people connect dots that none of us in government could have ever connected?
It seems, with government, as with many other organizations that are not public, that, you know, it's not exactly a culture of secrecy, but a culture of proprietorship.
And I think the contours of that, I mean, there are a lot of people are making this case, and I completely subscribe to it. The industrial economy is running out of steam. It's served us extraordinarily well for a century, but it's running out of steam. You've seen that again in the media and music industry and financial service industries. You're starting to see it in all large organizations. This default to close is now the default to open. It's collaboration. It's transparency. It's about building trust. And it's about having a two-way conversation. In private sector, if you're not having a two-way conversation with your customers, you're not going to be around a long time. In government, we have this default broadcast model. It's not going to work. And it's my argument for much longer. My argument is we need to wake up to this. And I do think it's not hyperbolic. These tools of technology, I mean, Twitter didn't exist 7 or 8 years ago. Facebook didn't exist. The cloud literally was in the sky. 4G was a parking space, LinkedIn a prison. These things didn't exist as we know them. We better wake up, eyes wide open to this world and the reality around us.
You point out that at least at the federal level, it's Republican lawmakers.
I'm shocked by this. Who are ahead of the curve. Former San Francisco mayor, this was upsetting to me. But God bless, you let the information lead you to where it goes. And Democrats do an exceptionally good job at using these tools of technology to get elected. And you contrast just the Romney and Obama campaign. But boy, when it comes to governing, we don't do necessarily as an effective job. Guys like Eric Cantor, Daryl Issa, remarkably, are doing more with this technology in terms of that day-to-day engagement than Democrats.
I don't know if I want to call it, well, I guess it is, crowdsourced bills. They are opening up pieces of legislation.
I love this idea. You're seeing all the contours of this change. You're seeing participatory budgeting, where it's not a budget that we show you at a town hall, and then you say, boy, I want more money on healthcare and police. And then all of a sudden, we claim that was real outreach. It's about literally opening the budget and the crowd, meaning the public, making real decisions about where the dollars go. citizen co-sponsor, one of the things that exists in the federal government, where people literally can co-sponsor bills and they're annotated about the amendments they make. And you can actually cite that you as an individual made an amendment, submitted to the House floor, that became ultimately law.
Eric Cantor actually went one step further with that, though. I'm not sure if he solicited a majority vote, but
I'm amazed. He's got, you know why, and I like Eric personally, but there's a real superstar. There's always behind the scenes. They never trust a politician's capacity. It's always his or her staff. In this case, Matt Lira, he's just a bloody genius. This guy is brilliant. He started the U-cut idea, which I thought was a petulant negative frame initially, but it was interesting. They had 700,000 people that came up and said, I'm going to decide what to cut in terms of waste in government. And they created a framework to understand that, you know, foreign, you know, the UN, of course, you look at their site, it's a very Republican frame, cut the UN, get rid of foreign aid. And then they realize, wait, even if you do that, that's less than 1% of the budget. Now what else do we do? And it showed how difficult some of these decisions are. So it was an educational tool, et cetera. Then he's created something along these lines called Citizen Co-Sponsor. I saw something called Project Madison. And they're just interesting ideas in the early stages. But I like them because in this respect, they don't treat taxpayers and citizens like subjects. They treat them, instead of doing things to us, they're doing things with us. And that's the frame, I think, of a 21st century government.
Gavin Newsom's with us. As I said, he's lieutenant governor of the state of California. So how are you taking these ideas?
I'm failing horribly as lieutenant governor. That's why I wrote the book, because we still have these. And don't be so upset if you're a member of these groups, but this sort of IT cartel. God bless them. I mean, we're still building out systems. We're still buying systems in a world where you have an on-demand resource, the cloud and apps, where you can rent them by the hour. And so we have a cultural mindset, even in California, 1970, I kid you not, we're on the cutting edge of 1970 technology in California.
Great.
Our DMV, 40-year-old patched together technology, it could collapse at any minute.
One thing that we've seen a lot of in Seattle are hackathons, and they're not sponsored by the government, but that's one thing that you would advocate.
I love hackathon. White hat hackers, as Stuart Brand used to talk about in his early days when he was fighting for the open data movement and came up with this idea of a personal computer with Wozniak and Jobs in the early 80s. It's the enlightened hackers. And you do these hackathons where people take these data sets and are able, for no cost to taxpayers, again, reputational, they mash things up, and all of a sudden, they're doing things that government, again, would have taken years to do, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, for free.
So while you're on this, I'm not sure if it's a national tour, but I'm pretty sure it is because I saw you on Stephen Colbert.
Oh, yeah.
And he can say things I can't on broadcast. Are you making appointments with mayors and governors and county executives?
Thank you for asking. I have a Citizenville challenge with a great organization called Code for America. And we got Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia, who's the head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, to be the first person to sponsor it. And Austin, Texas, we're all over the country. Mayors, Democrats, Republicans, agreeing to the principles under this challenge. At our website, citizenville.com, you'll see them, about openness, transparency, putting these data sets online, getting data officers, and not scraping the data, putting them out there and raw firm, and creating a whole new relationship with citizens. It's time for active citizenship. It's time for us to step up and step in. Don't allow government to do things to you. Start doing things with government. Start taking. I believe in government. I'm an advocate for government, but not the stale debate about small government, big government, limited government. Not the ideological debate. Real active participation.
Listening there, City Hall. Gavin Newsom's Lieutenant Governor of California, former mayor of San Francisco. His book is called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. And while you're absorbing that, we're going to turn to Michael Fagan, who takes us out into nature where we can come up with our own ideas. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Marcy.
What is raining, yeah?
Not yet, but I lucked out and snuck out yesterday and got plenty of sun. The sun's coming back. It's just taking a rest for the next couple of days. We have some light showers moving in later this afternoon. And Wednesday, some light rain. Actually, the best chance will be later in the day. So either of these 2 days, we're not expecting rain for the entire day. If you're looking for a good window of weather to catch the views, and that Friday through actually the entire weekend's looking dry with plenty of sun. So we'll see if that actually occurs. Our trip for this week, it's you could ski or snowshoe it. This is one of my favorites. It's right at Snoqualmie Pass. You go towards Kendall Peak. And our trip, we don't actually go to Kendall Peak or to the lakes because there can be some avalanche issues, but we go to this viewpoint, and we have the route of the viewpoint and the safe route on the website. And the numbers on this trip is reasonable. It's basically we're looking at 3.5 miles and 1,600 foot gain, 3.5 miles one way. And then you can obviously do less. And if you do snowshoe, the skiers would appreciate that you stay out of the ski track. Someone might get upset.
Well, this is, I mean, we're talking right up off the Gold Creek parking, the parking area, I think, which isn't that far from Seattle. And it's a little bit cooler. So I know last weekend the snow was kind of mushy.
Right. And it's today it's a cool start, actually. I think it was in the mid-20s and should warm up into the mid-30s today. So precipitation might be right on the cusp, rain or snow. Freezing levels drop on Wednesday, so we might get a mix of snow. But, yeah, over the weekend it will be warmer, so the snow will be mushy. So be prepared for that. If you don't want to deal with the mushy snow, you could go up early. And there's definitely some advantage, especially on the weekend, because, as you mentioned, this is by Gold Creek.
Easy.
It's a popular area. So if you get up early Saturday or Sunday, you could avoid some of the crowds and have a little firmer snow. And it's got some nice views at the viewpoint. You see the Catchless Lake, views of Kendall Peak. So it's really nice in that regard. If you don't want to be doing the hill up towards Kendall, you could just ski around Gold Creek. And you do need a snow park for this area, and it's Green Trails Map 207S. So this is a real good trip to do, and Friday through Sunday will be the best days if you're looking for some good views.
And you can see those views because Michael took some photos and posted them at hikewashington.net on a nice sunny day, so you get an idea of what it will look like. It's always fun to get out of town, though.
That's right, and this is a good one. It's close in enough you can just take off work.
Yeah, a little early.
Yeah, or
come in late.
People, they do this, what they call dawn patrol. They get up at 5 a.m. and they go skiing and head back to work at 10 a.m.
I know some of those same people. Michael Fagans with West Coast Weather LLC, his blog Fagans Weather World, gives us weekend forecasts and some good hikes that match those. And this week's hike, Kendall's Peak View at Snoqualmie Pass. And hopefully Friday and Saturday we'll have some nice weather to go out and do that. Otherwise, brave a little showers. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And now, the sound of the day. Anyone want to guess what that is? Sounds a little bit like rain, but it's actually the sound of thousands of hermit crabs congregating on a compost pile. I would never have guessed that. They're eating rotting pineapple rinds and pieces of watermelon. I would never have guessed that one. Bernard says, not him either. Weekday listener Annie sent in that sound after she and her husband vacationed in Belize. They stayed on a small island there that uses hermit crabs as natural garbage disposals, which sounds awesome. It's quite a sight to behold. If you want to watch it, you can visit our Facebook page, Weekday at KUOW. That's Facebook. And always, we encourage you to send your sounds. What are you listening to? Maybe not hermit crabs eating rotting pineapple, because that's pretty exotic, but maybe something close to home. Record 30 seconds of the sound and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email it to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Well, this was like the fast-paced hour of technology, from fractals to Citizenville and some hermit crabs and a little bit of hike. We're going to talk a lot about what we eat in the next hour. You may have seen a New York Times article about the Mediterranean diet and how that's going to cure us of heart disease and stroke. We're going to find out if that's really true. Also, the debate over GMOs. There's a proposal on the November ballot that would require labeling of all genetically modified foods. Is that a good thing, bad thing? What do you think? Also, gardening. Two-thirds of our gardening panel are here. That's all coming up in the next hour of the show. And if you missed anything, you can always find our archive programs at the website, kuow.org.
Every Saturday night, the Swing Years and Beyond takes you on a tour of popular music from the 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wild. Join me for the Swing Years and Beyond, Saturday nights, starting at 7 o'clock on 94.9 KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cornell Queens Executive MBA program, designed for mid-career managers and professionals, offering weekend classes in Seattle. Local admissions events March 5th and 7th. Information and event registration at cornellseattle.com.
Neil Iramea grew up in New Zealand's marginalized Pacific Island community. Few would have expected him to quit his job at the bank.
I told my parents that I wanted to go to dance school. My mother cried and my father simply just shook his head and walked away from me.
Now he directs New Zealand's top modern dance troupe, and his parents are solidly behind him. His story, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.